The KM Community Podcast, bringing you stories from Kent's communities every week.
Hello and welcome to the KM Community Podcast. I'm your host Oliver Kemp and I'm here to find the stories and issues at the heart of communities across the county. If you have a story you think needs to be told, just use the hashtag KMCommunity on social media, or you can email me at okemp@thekmgroup.co.uk. This week, as we near the halfway point of Black History Month, one charity is working hard to empower the black men and women of North Kent. The Medway African and Caribbean Association, or MACA, was set up in the 1980s as a way of doing exactly that, and since then it's become a voice for people in the area. Carol Stewart, the chairperson of MACA, joins me today to talk about how recognising young black achievers in the community is so important, the need to teach black history in schools, and bias in the police force.
The KM Community Podcast.
So, Carol.
Hello.
Welcome to the KM Community Podcast.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
So, tell us a little bit about how MACA began.
Crikey, it started off in a front room almost 35 years ago now this year. And it sort of, I don't know if you know much about sort of what they call the Windrush sort of generation, which obviously was 30 odd years before then. But I think there was a significant number of people from the African and Caribbean community that moved here to Medway initially and felt very kind of isolated and wanted to sort of like engage, socialise with each other. I think like many black organisations, they started out in somebody's front room, just as a means of just getting together, having a safe space, you know, meeting with friends, having a drink, having a game of dominoes, strategizing about various things and just trying to find their way in life, really. So it started out at a house in Gillingham and it's kind of grown from there, really. They were contacted by representatives from Medway Council who wanted to find a way to engage with the sort of black community around the issues that were impacting on the local authority at the time and looking at some of the plans they were making. And over the years, it's grown. So obviously, we're a charity now. We've been a charity for quite a number of years. And we formed a charity, not just because it provides access to funding, but I think it kind of broadens the scope, enables us to have a bit more structure. Because we were just like a voluntary organisation before. So it's all run by volunteers. We don't have any paid staff. And I think when people see the things that we do, they think there's about 40 or 50 of us and a big, massive building. And actually, we don't have our own space. We have a drop-in that meets every Tuesday at the Sunlight Centre from 1 till 4, and that's in Gillingham. And we kind of get a lot of support from, you know, the local authority, from the college, Mid-Kent College, University of Kent, University of Creative Arts, Chatham Historic Dockyard, the Arts Team, Black Workers Forum, and so many different organisations have kind of reached out to us because they want to engage, like Kent Police as well. We were instrumental in forming the independent advisory group, you know, with a number of other people who were act as like sort of critical friends. I remember when I first moved to Kent, I've been in Kent, you can hear a slight accent, Wolverhampton accent. So when I first moved here 19 years ago, and I think not long after I arrived here, there was a murder of a young man in Sheerness, Christopher Ananimi. And we were invited to be critical friends because I think at the time it was creating a lot. There was a lot of racial tension around the crime. It's obviously a race related murder. So out of that, and I think at that time, obviously from the McPherson report, one of the recommendations was to have a group of critical friends. So we were involved in setting up the sort of the Kent Independent Advisory Group, and I was chair for a number of years. And I got involved in MACA more or less as soon as I got here, you know, just basically just kind of starting out, going to some of the, we used to have social activities at the King Charles Hotel. And then we had like a Saturday school. It was a Sankofa Saturday school. Which is about kind of like reclaiming your roots. We used to have African dancing. We had arts and crafts. We went to an African village in Hertfordshire as well. And we taught the children. And it was children from all races and all ages about African and Caribbean history. We felt that was important because I think certainly moving here from the Midlands, and I think like for many black families that come from very diverse communities, when you come to Kent, your initial sort of view is that it's not very diverse. And going into, you know, sending my children to school, black history wasn't really taught then. And I remember, I think the one year, we managed to get an invite to go and meet the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And when my daughter and her friends went to school the next day, because it was all over the media, you know, this group of young kids from Medway get to meet, you know, an icon.
Yeah, it's a big deal, yeah.
It was a big deal. Yeah, we I can't remember which TV station it was, but yeah, but it was all over the news. And they went to school the next day and they says, oh, we met Jesse Jackson. And the school was like, oh, is he one of the Jackson Fives? You know, they didn't know who he was, which I think was quite sad, because what we've recognised was that, and this has been the same, I think, for centuries in schools, that when people are learning about black history, it tends to be about slavery and oppression, and they don't hear about the many significant achievements.
Ends up being a focus on the
exactly,
negative.
Exactly, yeah. So and so it's kind of grown over the years, really.
And you guys, because obviously it's been a year now since you put on Black History Live.
Yes,
yeah. It was a series of events throughout Medway and kind of
there
surrounding
was, yeah,
areas.
Over 3 years, yeah.
And that felt, and you had Untold Stories, which was the exhibition at the Dockyards.
It was, yes.
And that felt like that was like a big celebration and trying to you know, not just people who are in the African and Caribbean communities, but people outside
everybody,
of it to understand.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of reactions did you get from people who were attending that event?
Oh, it was just been amazing, because on my Facebook, I got a reminder about it, you know, a year ago, and I was like, oh, I really miss it. I want to do it again. but that was 3 years in the making. And obviously we had other events leading up to the penultimate one, which was the exhibition. So we had the play Black Heroes of Kent. We had an online resource, which the young people from Rochester Grammar and Mid Kent College helped create. We had a documentary which UCA sort of created as well. It was absolutely amazing. So that took place over 3 years. And then the exhibition itself, it was just every time like we went there, I mean, if you can imagine, we're very, very small charities, I was saying. So to go and see that exhibition, I kept thinking, oh, it's somebody else's that I'm coming to see, because I'm thinking, did we really do this? It's like, you know, because it was just something out of this world. I mean, the team at Circus, who were the creative team, what they did to create such a masterpiece, honestly, I don't know how they, you know, my hat goes off to them. But we had people there from literally all over the globe. You know, I think there were thousands and thousands of visitors, and we had some fantastic comments like, you know, this is amazing. And I feel a sense of pride, and I learned so much about history, and I didn't know about these families, and it was a fascinating experience to be involved in shaping it, and to see people's reactions, and to see the diversity of people as well, young, not so young, black, white, you know, everybody really, really enjoyed it.
And as you said, it's like a celebration.
It is, yeah. And I think what we wanted to do, because is to capture exactly what it was, those untold stories, because I say we always hear about the negative things. We always hear about, you know, the negative images in the media. And what we wanted to do was to change, was to paint a different picture, to say, well, you know, whenever you were sitting in your car at the traffic lights, do you realise it was a black person? And people say, well, why is it important? And it's important because we want young people to have a sense of achievement, you know, to have a sense of positive aspirations, that there are people that look like you that have done some amazing things. And also I think for the wider community, like the, you know, the white European community, to actually challenge their stereotype and to challenge their perception about who's done what in society and who's contributed towards, you know, this wonderful place that is Britain. And I think the exhibition achieved that. You know, when you look at some of the heroes that we learn about, I mean, and also, you know, Palm Cottage in Gillingham, there was the goddaughter of Queen Victoria. She actually, you know, adopted a young African woman, you know, saved her from getting killed. And all of those stories. I didn't know.
It's an amazing story, yeah.
Well, I've driven past Palm Cottage hundreds of times. You know, I didn't even know what it was. I just thought it was just some social club. But actually, really, it was the home of somebody that was connected to royalty. Mm. So it's things like that. And we just wanted to open people's eyes and ears to a different picture of history, and that we're not just black in October, that we're black all year round, and there's so many amazing things that we've achieved.
Do you think the fact that you got such a great reaction from all sorts of different people, all walks of life, do you think that that means that perhaps we need to have a rethink about what we are teaching in schools, and that we need to incorporate black history into our education system?
Definitely, definitely, definitely. And I think, you know, there was a school which, again, you know, without going over it, but they did a history lesson that they did a slave auction reenactment, and we did a lot of work with them after that to kind of look at redressing black history, but also not just history, I think the whole curriculum. So having conversations around, you know, when you're teaching English literature, talk about some black authors. When we've got Floella Benjamin, you know, there's so many different authors that have written books that you can incorporate into the curriculum. When you're teaching about science and maths and biology, just broaden the people that you're talking about so that everybody doesn't just grow up thinking, well, it's only white people that have done this. Actually, you know, we've done so much more, and that we're not just good at sports and music and the arts, but actually we've achieved so many different things.
Do you think that's like a criticism, like almost like a legacy criticism, that the Western canon, as some people call it, and you talk about the Western canon of literature created by white middle-class men who only decide to include very certain or specific authors,
exactly.
And that has a knockdown effect to
it
our
does.
Education system. So hopefully with things like the events that you put on and Black History Month and things like that, then there will be a knock-on effect to hopefully incorporate some of those
definitely.
Histories and legacies.
Yeah. I mean, like next year, for example, it's two significant milestones next year, and we kind of already know which one's going to get more prominence. So next year, it's the 150th anniversary of the death of Charles Dickens, and it's also the 150th anniversary of the death of William Cuffy, who was a Chartist. So we've been having conversations with Medway Council about, you know, you really need to do something to recognise this other important person, not just Dickens. So they're quite keen to do something. So we started conversations last week. You know, people that want to get involved, they can get in contact with us through our website. But we kind of, you know, wanting to make sure that Cuffy and others like him, you know, Adolphus Brown, who was a hero. You know, he saved people from a massive explosion in Woolwich in a factory, because that was part of Kent at the time. So we just want to have equal significance and play to some of the other characters in history and present day as we do Dickens.
Yeah. This is about rewriting that.
It is, yeah.
And of course, as you said, it's currently Black History Month.
Yes.
And as part of your work as MACA, you have the Young Black Achievers Awards.
Yes.
So I know your nominations closed last week and the event's taking place at the end of the month.
The 26th of October at Mid-Kent College, yes. So the award's been running for 14 years now. You know, I think in the first year we ran it, there was mixed reaction, and I think it was mainly, well, it was mixed in so much as I think some people didn't understand why we're doing it. You know, what about white young people? I said, well, actually, you know, white young people get recognised all the time. You know, you have like the Triangle Awards and stuff. And I think back then, not many black young people were getting recognition. And also, our young people were experiencing challenge and discrimination and racism, issues around self-esteem and confidence. So we wanted to do something that gave them a boost. Over the years, we've gone into prisons as well, where we've got young people that have received custodial sentences that are trying to turn their life around. So we've recognised those young people there. So we've given out, must be nearly 300 awards, I think, in the 14 years. So yeah, we're really excited about it. And we've had some amazing headline acts. We've had like Junior Giscombe, we've had Angela Maher, we had an artist from America as well, from Sounds of Blackness. And yeah, it's a great community event for everybody to come along. And over the past few years, we've broadened out the categories. So when my daughter was alive, she, along with some friends, set up Young People United. And that was funded through Starbucks. We had a lot of support from the Arts Team at Medway Council. And that was to bring young people from different walks of life and different diversities together to celebrate their achievements. So they had an event at Mid-Kent College in 2014, I think it was, which was amazing. And so when she died the following year, the young people wanted to do something to honour her memory. And the fact that she was such an inspiration, you know, her friends were like the United Colours of Benetton, is what I call them. So they wanted to do something to recognise the fact that she was a natural leader, she was an inspiration, but also to recognise young people who were championing diversity in the community. So that's where the YPU Awards was born. So the Diversity Awards, again, we get people nominated who've made a significant contribution towards championing diversity. And then the Inspirational Award is from young people, you know, about another young person. And then we had the Windrush Awards, which was launched last year.
Yeah, so this will be the second year of the Windrush Awards, right?
To recognise people from the Windrush sort of like generation or who've contributed towards recognising the Windrush generation. And MACA also gives out honorary awards as well to people who we feel have raised the profile of sort of black people, their contribution across Kent and Medway as well. So it's an exciting event. And then me and Trish get a chance to do our crazy thing on stage. So,
a bit of dancing, I hope.
We're a bit of a double act. You know, people have compared us to, what are those people on Britain's Got Talent? I've forgotten their name now.
Do you know what you're asking? The wrong person, Carol.
Yeah.
I don't think I've watched a single episode.
Yeah, but they compared. They said, oh, we're better than, that's it, Ant and Dec. We're better than Ant
and Dec. Oh, Ant and Dec, yes. Yeah.
They said, well, you're funnier than Ant and Dec. You know, I said, oh, you know, it's just, we just make it up as we go along.
It's a good review, better than Ant and Dec.
Exactly,
you
yeah.
Get a lot of people coming along. I mean, speaking of Windrush, obviously we're now well over a year on since the Windrush scandal and Amber Rudd resigning from the cabinet.
Yeah.
Do you think enough has been done by the government to rectify the situation? Or can a situation like that even be rectified? Is this more of a systemic issue?
I think it is. I don't think enough has been done to rectify it. There are still people who I know haven't come forward and won't because they're fearful that they're not going to meet the criteria, you know, to get their length of stay. I mean, they were children, you know, for crying out loud, when they came over here. You know, their parents answered the call from Enoch Powell to come here. And I think everyone tends to forget that. You know, it's funny that, you know, Amber Rudd resigned, but then she was brought back in. And I think, you know, because certain people needed it, certain votes in order to keep their seat. I think, you know, major significant compensation, I think, is due. I know people that have been kicked out of the country, you know, with health conditions. So I think the people are still suffering. I really don't think there's enough to be done. But I think it is, you know, systemic of or representative of an environment, an uncomfortable environment that we're living in now. You know, with the whole Brexit situation, the whole Windrush situation, what's going on in America, it just feels an uncomfortable place right about now. I think for the past few years, I think before, during, and after the referendum, it's just felt horrible, you know, and it's kind of taken, I think, some of us back to a time that we wanted to forget, you know, in terms of the overt racism. It just seems to be rearing its head again.
Yeah, it feels like that there's an increase of intolerance. And you think, because of your position, you're almost like a spokesperson for communities that are not always talked about.
No.
Do you really feel that there has an intolerance that has crept in over the last few years?
It's not so much, I prefer not to use the word intolerance because I think it assumes that there's something that people need to tolerate. I think it's more so much about acceptance and understanding and appreciation. And people reliving or revisiting stereotypes that they had about certain groups of people. So I think, you know, it's been a difficult time and a very challenging time. And, you know, when you're walking down the road and, you know, the day after Brexit, people saying, what are you still doing here? And getting called the N-words, you know, because I used to live on the island. And I remember when I was going to vote and walking past the some people and they were shouting at their balcony the N-word, you know, quite loud enough for me to hear, quite blatant about it. And for the first time in my voting life, I felt really uncomfortable. You know, just the whole atmosphere there, it was just like, yeah, it was horrible.
And do you, yeah. I mean, as someone who's at the forefront of you speaking to people in the community with the sunlight surgery that you do every week, do you find that there are people that approach you that have had similar experiences like that in Medway?
Yeah, I think that and a range of things, you know, particularly because we do a lot of work with Kent Police. And so we get told about other issues where people have been the victim of crime, whether it's like hate crime, and don't want to report it, or they might witness an incident and don't want to come forward because of fear of retaliation or because of lack of trust and confidence. But I know that I think we're doing quite a lot of work with Kent Police to address those issues. You know, we're quite forthright about it and say, we know, well, about what they need to do. Because I think a lot of it is around training, because we used to be involved in recruitment and training of the police some years ago. And it's a shame that has stopped, you know, to a certain extent.
Do you think is it an unconscious bias? Is that what it comes down to with policing?
I think it's conscious and unconscious, you know. So because I did an exercise with some young people about 11 years ago where we were looking at the children's workforce and how they can engage with children and young people. And it was labelled, you know, hard to reach. And they were saying, well, we're not actually hard to reach. It's just that we're here, just that they don't see us. So they reframed the exercise. And we did an exercise on looking at stereotypes, and the young people came up with these cards. And one of them, it had like a silhouette of some people. You didn't know what age they were, but they had hoods on. And they did that because they said that very often you might be walking down the road and you'll see somebody with a hoodie or a tracksuit, and people will have these sort of perceptions. And I remember when we were doing some training with the police years ago, and one of them, you know, jumped up and says, I don't understand why I can't stop every, you know, black person coming out of Gillingham Station wearing certain things because they could be a yardie. And I says, well, I don't look at every white person and assume that they're a paedophile or, you know, a rapist or whatever. So it's about painting people with the same brush. And I think it's just about people being aware of their own conscious and unconscious bias. And it comes across in like body language as well. So I think there's still quite a lot to be done.
And yeah. When it comes down to that conversation as well, and police officers wanting to stop people and things like that, it makes you think about the conference that you were part of last month, which was the Point Conference, which was the whole point of that was to discuss knife crime and to discuss workable solutions, but also to talk about some of the misconceptions of knife crime.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because I think when I see stuff online, because I think, you know, I know Kent's report came of the Kent News Group has reported a lot about some of the incidents. I mean, there was the murder in Maidstone at the nightclub the other week. So, and whenever there's a report of knife crime in the papers, and I see people's comments and they're saying, oh, you know, it's because of all these black families coming down from London. Not all, you know, knife crime is committed by people from any race, any age, any background, but there is this perception that it's black young people, and it's black families coming down from London.
Is that partly why you wanted Macca to be involved in a talk about that?
There was that as well. And I think to have the conversation that, you know, because I think when you look at some of the responses to violent crime, particularly around like gun and knife crime, it's been very London-centric or Manchester-centric or Birmingham. So people don't think that there's a problem in Kent. And I'm like, well, actually there is, because if there wasn't, we wouldn't be having this conference. We wouldn't be having this conversation. So, and I say it's better to have the conversation now when it's not so much, it's not a bigger problem as it is in some of the other cities, so that you can prevent it from escalating to that stage, really. And I think we need to have more conversations about personal safety and conflict resolution. Because when you've got young people or anybody resorting to violence to resolve conflict, then we've got a problem. So whether it's knives or guns or physical acts of violence or whatever, we have a problem around how conflict is managed. And that starts a lot from in the home. It also from what they see on the TV as well. It was an interesting debate recently over the new film, The Joker.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody put online today that, you know, do they think that it might lead to a rise in certain types of crime? I said, well, you could say that about any film. You remember the Rambo? You might be not old enough to remember Rambo.
I've seen it. Yeah. I wasn't old enough when it came out, but yeah. I have seen it, yeah.
But, you know, you look at Rambo, you look at all the Die Hard movies, you know, you look at a lot of the Western movies, the Cowboys movies that used to be out, you know, years ago. And that was how conflict was dealt with. You know, you shoot somebody, you blow up somebody, you know what I mean? You know, but the industry will make what sells. You know, having a movie with people sitting down, having a, you know, a conversation about their difficulties doesn't sell as much as blood and gore. So, and I think it's about flipping the script really and having having more positive images. So there are films and there are songs where nobody has to die. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
It's changing that. Yeah. And lastly, Carol, so... Mm. Well, you were at the knife crime conference. There was a lot of practitioners and academics there.
Yes.
And there was a couple of solutions suggested, obviously, yeah. kind of intensive inverted commas there, because, you know, yeah. can there ever be a true solution to it?
No.
Did you come out of that thinking that there's kind of a plan been put forward here? Or is it just an ongoing debate?
I think it's an ongoing debate. I mean, certainly from our point of view, we want to continue having the discussions with families. I mean, we had a session with teachers in the afternoon, and then with parents. And parents were, you know, quite rightly saying, look, I don't know what to do. You know, they, so what the police did, which I thought was really helpful, was they gave information about signs to look out for. You know, if your child comes home with, you know, new set of trainers, or they're hanging out late, or they even maybe like sort of fearful for going out, you know, there are little things you can look out for. Obviously, you've got, you know, numbers like Crime Stoppers and whatever, but, you know, a lot of parents are fearful about, you know, looking under the pillow in their child's room, all those kinds of things. So I think it's important for parents to get to know what, you know, who their children's circle of friends are, get them involved in safe activities, and have the conversation, particularly around things like having a positive relationship with yourself first, having a positive, healthy relationship, loving yourself. And being confident, you know, and knowing that there are people they can talk to, even if it isn't their mum or their dad, you know, an uncle or auntie, a youth worker or anyone, to have a conversation about feeling safe. So that was quite nice to do. I think we want to, as I say, keep having the discussions, looking at, you know, some practical solutions, going into schools. I think more needs to be done in schools to talk to young people about personal safety.
Well, yeah. Carol, you've given us a lot of the food for thought there, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
The KM Community Podcast, bringing you stories from Kent's communities every week.